You're tuned into Madiba's Radio, broadcasting live from Nelson Mandela University.
I have fought against white domination, and I have fought against death domination. I have carried the idea of a democratic and free society, in which all persons live together in harmony and with equal opportunity. It is an idea which I hope to live for and to achieve. But if needs be, it is an idea for which
I am prepared to die. Nelson Mandela University. Change the world. You're tuned into Madiba's Radio, changing the world one voice at a time.
What's good? What's up? You are listening to The Law Show right here at Madiba's Radio. We connect, inform, and absolutely engage. My name is Katlego Mofokeng, and I am known as Girl with the Nice Pants on the Instagram streets. The Law Show brings you the struggle for justice into everyday language, unpacking the law, politics, and the lived experiences of South Africa's youth. Now, on today's episode, we look at the decades since the Fees Must Fall movement and its deep connection to Workers' Day. As we commemorate both, we reflect on what happens when students and workers unite for justice and ask, have we moved forward or simply pacified the resistance? Now, you're going to hear quite a lot about the Must Fall movement. I mean, this marks 10 years since the Must Fall movement. It is Africa Month. It is Mental Health Awareness Month. It is Workers' Month. So all of these things coming together, we're going to reflect on the sacrifices that were made by the youth in 2015. You're going to hear quite a lot of it this month, especially. It is Africa Month. We are going to delve deeper into topics surrounding what it means to decolonize institutions and systems of control, what it means to reclaim our power, what it means to go back to Africa, or what we imagine Africa to be. So this month is about to be a banger. But if you've got me, it's going to be even more of a blast. I am talking today about Fees Must Fall and Workers' Day. And this is based on a lecture that I went to held by the EFF Youth Command at the Melody Cafeteria on the 2nd of May. That was Friday. It was really great. Everybody had a blast. And I think more than anything, the information that we gained there, the questions that were asked, are so necessary in understanding the way or the posture of the student populace. So it was amazing. But we're going to take it back. I guess we have to give you context and background in order to get into the actual topic of conversation. So don't worry about it. I got you. I have to explain to you what Workers' Day is and when it actually is. I mean, you're just probably surprised there's a bunch of long weekends that have just been following each other. And then just why? Is it a vibe? Is it holidays that just follow each other week after week? Or what's going on? But Workers' Day itself, that is, it's observed on the 1st of May, and it's more than just a public holiday. It's a remembrance and a reckoning. It traces back to the brutal days of apartheid when black South African workers were treated as cheap, disposable labor, stripped of basic rights, fair wages, and human dignity. The origins of this day lie in defiance. In 1986, COSATU, which was only a year at the time, called for a massive stay away. It wasn't just about poor conditions, it was about power. That day, workers laid down their tools and refused to make the economy run, and in doing so, they made history. Workers' Day became a symbol of collective resistance, economic, ideological, and deeply political. I think in today's day and age, it's quite hard to manage something as unified as a stay away. In any case, we've noticed it with the boycotting ever since the Palestinian genocide. People have seen that many companies themselves are actually directly or indirectly funding a war that is happening. And there'd been calls to boycott these companies, you know, these corporations. And how many of you have stuck to it? How many of you have indulged in all of the products that are offered by these companies? It's very difficult to do nowadays than it was back then. And I think it's because of the fact that we don't really have a collective consciousness as a people. We're not understanding of the fact that actually, this is something greater than all of us. And we're not used to surrendering ourselves to something greater than all of us. And that's okay. No judgment from my side. It's understandable. But at the end of the show, I want you to have taken away the understanding of why it is that we need to be unified. Why we need to be unified in resisting some of the things that the system actually continues to push out against us. A system that is set out to hurt us, how best to resist it, and how best to be unified in resisting said system. So it's okay, there's no judgment here. Even I may or may not have allegedly indulged in the forbidden fruits, veggies, and the like that are being offered by these corporations that stand to gain from the loss of the lives of Palestinians in the war in Gaza. So it's understandable that we don't understand the gravity of what happened. A lot of the times we've been called the born frees. And it's because of the fact that we don't understand what it took. For Freedom Day, Freedom Day was about the first ever elections, democratic elections at that. We take that for granted. And we saw that last year with the national elections. We saw the fact that a lot of the youth were not willing to stand in lines the entire day in order just to place a vote. We saw the fact that they're very comfortable being apathetic to what's going on in the country, but are the loudest and the most impacted by any and every policy that is created by said government, that they're choosing not to elect into power. So actions have consequences, and we're realizing that ourselves. And we're realizing that the workers of the apartheid regime knew that their actions to stay away from work would result in a complete standstill in the economy, because they knew they were the backbone of the economy. And indeed, the economy did stand still. And they got the voices of the people that they needed to sit at a table with. So it's important for us to understand what collective resistance is and how it can be economic, ideological, and deeply political. Now today, we still live with the aftermath of that economic apartheid. We see it in the exploitation of campus ground staff, in the quiet suffering of cleaners and security workers who hold the infrastructure of our universities together, yet remain invisible. And we've seen this when the Nahau strike took place last year, and many students were looking at it more as an inconvenience than an understanding that these people who keep this institution going are an integral part of this institution and deserve to be treated as such. They deserve to be compensated as such. And we really remember, those of us who stay on campus were very aware of it, because the conditions of the residences during that time, appalling to say the least. And then you realize, oh, mama, that you see cleaning, you know, taking out the trash, helping out. Oh, mama, that you just walk past and sidestep like they're nothing. Those people, those are mothers, those are uncles, those are fathers. They're providing for their families. And all they're asking for is dignity, to be treated with dignity, to be compensated adequately so as to maintain the dignity of the families that they represent when they are in this institution taking care of the students. So be aware, Botho is not just about looking at your peers and saying, you know, I am because we are, or even just looking at your communities. It starts with just generally being able to greet when you walk into a room, being able to speak to people with kindness, being genuine, being a decent human being overall, and understanding that everybody has an inherent human dignity. So treat them with that dignity. Now, I'm getting a little deep about it, but we also need to look at it within, we need to look at Workers' Day hand in hand with Fees Must Fall. Now, in many ways, the Fees Must Fall movement of 2015 inherited the fire of Workers' Day. That uprising wasn't just about tuition. It was about access, decolonization, dignity, and absolutely labor. Students realized that the people who made campus function, the workers, were being outsourced, underpaid, and denied basic benefits. And at NMU, insourcing became one of the key victories of Fees Must Fall. Students and workers stood side by side demanding better conditions for cleaners, security guards, and other essential staff. It was a moment of solidarity across class lines, a recognition that justice isn't selective. If our parents, our neighbors, and the workers we pass every day on campus aren't treated with dignity, then our education is literally being built on inequality. And that's the uncomfortable truth. Many institutions would prefer we forget that the struggle for insourcing was won at a great cost. Through blood, mass dismissals, and institutional hostility. The bureaucratic culture that replaced apartheid didn't lose its teeth. It just got a corporate makeover. Now, the dialogue that we had reflected on all of this. On Friday last week, the dialogue dared to ask, where are we now, almost 10 years since Fees Must Fall? And what does it mean to honor Workers' Day in the context of higher education? Many of us don't know this, and I would hope that we do. Workers worked alongside students during the Fees Must Fall movement. The Must Fall movement itself took on like a completely different phase. So what began as the need to remove the representation of a colonial past through the statue of Cecil John Rhodes became something even bigger. The understanding that not only do we need to decolonize these institutions of higher learning, but also we were promised free education and we want free education. We want to be able to go to school without having to worry about whether or not we can pay for it. Issues of access mainly go back to finances. A lot of them do. And so the Must Fall movement took on different faces and it covered like a wide range of things. And amongst them were workers' rights, laborers' rights. And Nehawu was part and parcel of this in understanding the fact that abantwana bayakhala, not only do they not see their faces or representations of themselves in their curriculum, not only are they fighting for access to higher institutions of higher learning, not only are they facing access issues to residences, to registration because of finances or the lack thereof, but the workers are also having a problem. They are being hired under an agency, paid pennies, and then expected to continue to work to their fullest potential in these places that exploit them and just hope for the best. So they came together and it was a very, very big fight. And that's why it's important for us to understand the fact that we're not alone in this fight. We don't fight in isolation. And that's what community is. Community is understanding the fact that you're not alone in a fight that you have, especially with a system that seeks to break down each and every person that seeks to speak out against it. You're not alone in that fight. But you need to also understand where everybody else is coming from. It's important so that when we finally do attain what it is that we've been wanting for the longest time, everybody eats at that same table. People should not be on the other side of the door looking through the window or people seeing you eat when they were fighting alongside you. And a lot of the questions were asked about the gains from Fees Must Fall, especially for workers, and whether or not they'd been actually, they were actually gains, and whether they were regressing. And it's such a valid question, because 10 years is a very, very long time. I think we don't realize it because, hey, Dallas Kowa. Ribo, whatever king, Ribo number one, Kulu, Varatso, Hara, Robala. But like, 10 years is a very, very, very long time. And a lot of life has happened in those years. But how much policy has? How much implementation has? But how well have these systems adapted to things that happened during Fees Must Fall? Systems will adapt so as not to be broken by events such as that, but they will not adapt to implement all of the things that they promised during that time. And that is heartbreaking. That now we are living in a system where at school, if there's a protest, everything goes online. And you have online classes and you call it a day. But these problems aren't sorted out immediately. There's an entire framework you have to follow. And many students don't know about the framework themselves. And I think that in and of itself is something that we need to explore. That's why I'm saying we need a collective consciousness. We need to be aware of the resources available to us in order for us to do certain things. I absolutely understand that when you're hungry, the first thing you're not thinking of doing is sitting down, writing down a list of demands, and then sending it to your house comm. Then the house comm talks to whoever else, and then it reaches the SRC, who then have to still liaise with whoever. And then, yes, I understand it's a lengthy process. It really, 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 really is. But that's the process that they're putting in place. And if you don't follow that type of process, best believe they're not trying to listen to what it is that you have to say. But now, when you're protesting, it needs to be clear that we've been communicating for the longest time with you. You have heard our cries and clearly don't understand that this is a matter of urgency. So now we're showing you that this is a matter of urgency. Deal with it urgently. But more often than not, a protest should be, honestly, the last part of the process wherein you engage with the university on that level. But I'm realizing more often than not that, you know, people, though they may not be aware of the framework, they are very understanding of the fact that, yes, you're supposed to communicate with certain bodies in the school in order to make them aware of the problems that you're facing. So you need to know, yes, the rules and the different parts of the framework. And your leaders are also responsible for teaching you about the different types of steps within the framework. But you yourselves are smart enough to say, I'm going to send the dean of students an email because it's falling on deaf ears if I'm speaking to maybe my res manager or my RSA or my house comm. So let me just take it a step further. You're smart enough to do that. And you know what the thing is? A lot of you are all smart enough to do that and then flood emails. That's why this week laptops are being dispersed. Because it's been a common thing that has been cried about. The meal management system, the policy itself and how it works, those conversations being had with NSFAS and the institution are as a result of the fact that you all collectively decided, okay, let's speak to the person in charge and tell them that we're not happy or satisfied with what it is that they're providing us with. That is collective resistance. It looks different in every generation. And it's going to look different in ours because we're the social media clickety-clack type. We know how a keyboard works. We're very quick to take a picture or a video, and we're very quick to also send an email. We're not afraid of that. We're not afraid to tell people when there's a problem and to speak out against it. And the beautiful thing is the fact that you have it in writing, understanding the fact that once you have things in writing, that counts in amazing ways towards you. If you can recall each and every time you've sent emails regarding a specific issue and then detail it properly, you've won. So you might not know about the frameworks. That's on your leaders, and it's important for them to let you know. But that's also on me. It's important for me to let you know. But I'm proud of the fact that you don't just sit as a people. You don't just sit when you have an issue and cry about it amongst your peers. You speak out, and that is the most amazing thing anyone could ever possibly ask for. Now, at the lecture that was held by the EFFYC, there was a keynote speaker, Mr. Manelisi Klaas, who is a chairperson of NEHAU's NMU branch and a veteran of student affairs and labor organizing. And he made it clear, Workers' Day must be a space of continued mourning and mobilization. From the Maracana massacre in 2012, where 34 striking miners were gunned down by police, to the silencing of campus workers who speak out against injustice, South Africa's working class still bleeds. He reminded us that education is increasingly becoming a luxury in a society where the majority still live with the same structural barriers they did a decade ago. He wasn't alone, though. His respondent, Maxwell Ngwenya, a seasoned student leader, reflected on Marx's theory of class struggle and reminded the audience that fees must fall wasn't just a flash in the pan. It was part of a historical revolution led by the poor and working class. And for him, insourcing wasn't just a policy win, it was a restoration of human dignity. That dialogue was amazing. And the hard questions, like, have the victories of the fees must fall been eroded? Why do we still see private security at student events? Why are insourced workers still treated as disposable? And perhaps most importantly, how do we as students and future professionals sustain the legacy of the movement? Were asked. And you can imagine when you're having a lecture and then you're hit with those questions, you'd be nervous. I would be personally. But they came through. And the consistent theme in their answer was solidarity, and not in theory, but in action. There was a call to build forums where students and workers can organize together, where political leadership can be held accountable, and where knowledge of labor law and institutional policies becomes part of the student consciousness. Literally, a reiteration of what I've just been saying the entire time. And now, despite the energy and sacrifice that marked the Fees Must Fall movement, the truth is, much of the work remains unfinished. Yes, NMU and several other institutions began the process of insourcing after massive pressure. But for many workers, the only thing that changed was the name on their payslip. The material conditions of their lives have not shifted in any meaningful ways. Some now receive medical aid, others are on institutional contracts, but very few feel secure, respected, or even valued. Several workers remain excluded from full-time employment status, creating an environment of fear rather than freedom. And with students, many leaders from the Fees Must Fall era have graduated or moved on or still in court cases regarding that. And the current crop of student leadership faces a very different landscape, one with voter apathy, political fragmentation, and an increasingly transactional relationship with the institution. It's hard for people, especially for leadership, to organize. It's more reactive than anything else. And the silence around insourcing today is not accidental. Universities have quietly shifted public attention away from their labor practices, often co-opting the language of transformation without addressing the deep-rooted inequalities that still define their operation. There is little to no political education for first-year students around the history of these struggles. Fees Must Fall has become a sanitized, depoliticized reference point rather than a call to action. And many, many don't know the realities of Fees Must Fall. Many don't know what actually happened during that time. It's the same thing with June 16. The realities of the day, as compared to how now it is depicted, are completely different. There is a big contrast. And it's worrying because it means those who are hearing about it don't understand the gravity of what it is that we're talking about. Don't understand the fact that though it may be a cleaner or your older cousin, it could be you one day. You could end up being a protester with a rubber bullet in your abdomen. You could end up being a former student activist in court fighting an institution. You could end up not being able to complete your studies, to further your studies, because you've been blackballed throughout the entire country. And those types of things happen to people who speak out against a system such as this, an unjust system. So it is up to us to understand that we all need to fight against the system together, collectively. Because what happened to the workers in the Marikana massacre is not an isolated event. Fees Must Fall is not an isolated event. Many others have happened before. Which begs the question, how do we as a collective decide to stand on our feet and recover from all of these things, but make sure the fact that what our mission is, as Fanon says, we actually achieve it. How do we best achieve our mission? And the unfinished work demands the formation of formal worker-student alliances where both groups co-create platforms of solidarity beyond protests. Curriculum interventions that make labor history and constitutional rights central to student life so that every graduate leaves with not only a degree but political literacy. Demanding transparency from university management about insourcing processes and resisting the commodification of student politics, where students and parties treat student issues as performance instead of praxis. Real activism means organizing even when there are no cameras, no elections, and no media attention. Now, this work is slower than a protest. It is quiet, often thankless, but it is the kind of work that builds power that lasts beyond one term in office or one march to the admin building. Because the worker who wakes up at 4 a.m. to clean our lectures is still waiting. The student who drops out due to unpaid fees is still disappearing from the system. And freedom without economic justice is not freedom at all. Remember, Workers' Day isn't just a look back. It's a mirror held to our present. And Fees Must Fall isn't just a memory, it's a mission. The spirit of 2015 is alive in the hallways, in the voices of campus staff, and in every student who believes that education should be a right, not a privilege. So let's keep asking, whose shoulders are we standing on? And what kind of system are we building? That's it for The Law Show this week. Until next time, stay conscious and stay in the fight. I have been Katlego Mofokeng, also known as Girl with the Nice Pants on the Instagram streets. And this is Madiba's Radio Podcast, where we connect, inform, and absolutely engage.
What's up? It's Coolie Chana.
How many more licks will it take till I get to this senegada? Cause I've been at it since the past 18. Thank you, okay, now, can
I? Yo, this is your boy Ricky Rich.
Oh, I know it's on the ground. Oh, I say, oh, 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 I
Yo, what up? This is Questa. Thank God.
All the stars. All the hits. This is Madiba's Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Madiba's podcast. My name is Pearl. We'll be catching up on all things science, health, tech, and environment. And now, without further ado, let's jump into it. The Constitutional Court says that prisoners can now use computers to study in their cells. And fuel price relief is coming up this Wednesday, and we'll be looking into how much motorists will be paying. Eastern Cape Police are currently investigating the theft of 17 firearms that have been stolen from the Human Stops Traffic Department, and 40 billion Eastern Cape Green Energy Cluster is expected to reach financial close in 2027. Now let's jump right into it. On our first headline, we're talking about the Constitutional Court saying that prisoners can now use computers to study in their cells. Well, so this was a unanimous ruling. The Constitutional Court declared that barring prisoners from using personal computers in their cells for studying is unconstitutional. The court ordered that the constitutional invalidity be suspended for a year and directed the National Commissioner of Correctional Services to promulgate a revised policy. So pending that, the court said that any inmate registered as a student with a recognized tertiary or further education institution and who reasonably needs a computer to support their studies will be entitled to use their personal computer in their cell, but without the use of an internet modem. So such inmates would be required to make the computer available for inspection at any time in the event of a breach of rules, and after consideration, representations from the inmate, the head of correctional center rather may direct that the inmate may not use the computer in their cell. So I want us to kind of underline the part where it says they would be entitled to use their personal computer in their cell, but without the use of an internet modem, right? So let's underline that. Let's bold that. So this was happened on Wednesday. Is to a large degree the same as ruling handed down by the Supreme Court of Appeal, which back in November 2023 also found that the blanket ban was unconstitutional. So that order was taken on appeal by the Minister of Justice and Correctional Services and the National Commissioner of Correctional Services. So Justice Stephen, who penned the Constitutional Court ruling, said the issue in the matter was the right to further education, right? So he said the blanket ban emanated from a departmental policy approved in February of 2007. So the initial challenge to it was launched in the High Court by Mbalenhle Sydney Ntuli, represented by lawyers for human rights, who was serving a 20-year sentence for robbery. So essentially, Ntuli had complained that he was struggling to complete his data processing course because he could not walk from his cell where he spent most of his time. So while conceding that prisoners had a right to further education under Section 29 of the Bill of Rights, the minister and commissioner argued that allowing prisoners to keep laptops in their cells would create a security threat. So Justice Menjiad said it was a common cause that Ntuli had since passed and graduated. He said that almost the entire factual matrix is undisputed. So after Ntuli had been transferred to medium C from medium B, his laptop was then taken away and he was told to use the computers in the computer room. So however, the computer room was only open during certain hours, right? So only occasionally at weekends and never on public holidays. So it was exceptionally noisy also in the computer rooms. So Ntuli said that he was being deprived of sufficient time to study. The minister and the commissioner in opposition to the application expressed concerns that inmates might smuggle modems in their cells or use illegal cell phones to create hotspots.
I think they made a really, really, the minister and the commissioner made a really good point, because recently, I think, was it last year, late last year, cell phones, drugs, earphones, chargers, a bunch of illegal things were confiscated at a very big correctional services, prison. So I think this opposition to the application genuinely made sense, and still does make sense, looking back at what has transpired or what is currently transpiring in South African prisons. So Justice Manjeet said that the High Court took the view that the applicants had not provided any evidence that where computers have been allowed in cells, even with a modem, there had been any security breach. So it further held that the respondent had the right to study as much as he pleased within the legitimate limitations that prison life inevitability presents. Right. So in the first appeal, I know, mouthful, right? In the first appeal, the SCA held that the policy infringement, the right, held that the policy infringed the right to further education. So in the Constitutional Court, the minister and the commissioner argued that Nduli was not being divested in his right to further education, but that the right was merely being regulated in a reasonable manner. Okay, so Nduli had only been allowed to use his computer in his cell back in medium B, right? Because there was no computer room at that time. So their security concerns were justifiable, and the court should not second guess the authorities on this issue. So Nduli's lawyers, however, argued that the policy is antiquated, old, that a personal computer was critical to success in his field of study, that electronic versions of books cost less than hard copies, and that downloading study materials from the website was much faster than the conventional postal service. The Judicial Inspectorate for Correctional Services, which was admitted as an amicus curiae, also known as friend of the court, submitted that in terms of international law, South Africa was obligated to adopt and implement educational policies that meet the needs of incarcerated persons to be part of an equal, fair and just society. So the policy should not unreasonably infringe the rights of rights to education by prohibiting the use of necessary tools. Justice Manjeet said that incarceration does not take away or limit fundamental rights like education, dignity and access to reading material. He said that the virtues of education had rightly not been disputed. To directly quote, he said that they are concerned with a limitation of the right of a person pursuing further education to have access to electronic study material. So it matters not that the person is an inmate, really though, because he enjoys all the rights accorded to non-inmates, save as they are reasonably limited in consequence of his incarceration. I think this might spark a huge debate. I'll tell you why after I finish this this part. So the duty of the state, right, is to remove barriers to education and actively allow access to necessary resources to realize the right to education. That is according to Justice Manjeet. So the blanket ban limited that right. Regarding the justification for the limitation that the right to further education does not mean having a personal computer at all times in a cell, the justice said that the simple answer is that to that is that access to the computer room is wholly inadequate and in effect boils down to an unjustifiable limitation. So regarding fears of security breaches, he said that this attempted justification does not get out of the starting gate because the minister and commissioner had not produced evidence to back up their claims. He went on to say that there is simply a glaring dearth of evidence to substantiate these security concerns, that it is not what is expected of these responsible for the policy. He said, which applied to all and sundry without any regard whatsoever to personal circumstances and study needs. He said the minister and the commissioner complained that SCA had ventured into the exclusive policy terrain of executive. So he went on to argue that their argument was ill-conceived. Courts have a constitutional duty as a check and balance on executive power to determine the constitutional validity of any law or conduct. They, which are the minister and the commissioner, do not have unfettered power to implement policies which undermine the constitution. He went on to say that the case was only concerned with the rights of prisoners to personal computers for educational purposes, saying that nothing in that judgment should be regarded as expressing a view He went on to say that nothing in this judgment should be regarded as expressing a view on the justifiability of restrictions on the use of personal computers in cells for any other purpose, right? What I meant to say that this might spark debate, right? Now, you find that we understand that it's everyone's constitutional right, né, to education. Everyone has a right to education, free education, for that matter. But how is it fair? A prisoner, as much as this does not focus on the fact that you are a prisoner, whatever crime you committed on the outside, you can, you know, be arrested, right, and spend your years in prison, but you want to study because you studied outside, but you want to further your studies, right? So how is it that a person who's committed heinous crimes is afforded the right to further their lives, further their studies, better their lives, I guess, or whatever they call it. But the person that they committed those heinous crimes to is finding it so hard to move on. You know, they're finding it so difficult to go on with their lives. They're stuck in one place because of this one traumatic experience that they went through because of a certain person. But you're in prison, you're sitting there, you having the time of your life because, I mean, you have a personal computer, you are studying, you are doing whatever you're doing. I think also, setting aside the fact that a person might have committed heinous crimes and all that, and the justice saying that, no internet modem would be allowed on the use of personal computers. How is it that they're going to be able, all these people involved, the minister, the commissioner, I get why they opposed the application, but how was it going to be, what's this word, man? How is it going to be allowed? How is it going to be monitored? Yes. How is it going to be monitored that internet modem is not smuggled in prisons? Looking at the state of our prisons right now, looking at how it's so easy to escape the maximum prison. It's so easy to smuggle drugs, cigarettes, phones, chargers. You can literally communicate with someone in prison. How is it so easy to do that? How is it so easy to escape prison? There's a lot that you can, that needs to be considered in actually allowing prisoners to have personal computers in their cells and not go to a public area where everyone is there when they can be guarded. like every minute of every day and how they use these computers. So it's, that's what I'm saying. It's a lot. You might find that there are other people that are against and there are other people that are for. But in both of these debates, you have to consider the pros and cons, right? But while we are still on prisons and prisoners, Coming Soon apparently is a fund to help people pay bail. So more than 2,600 awaiting trial detainees are stuck in overcrowded South African prisons because they cannot afford to pay a bail of less than 1,000, right? Many more cannot afford low bail amounts of more than 1,000 rand. But not before we continue, I just want to say we need dedicated investigative officers. We need people that are dedicated in investigation, people that want to do thorough work before a person is sentenced in prison. So we can, you know, and all those things. So the Bail Fund Working Group, led by the Judicial Inspectorate for Correctional Services and with the support of the Betha Center and other organizations, will soon launch a small pilot project to help these detainees who have been granted bail but cannot afford it. So during a working group meeting on Thursday, JISC Inspecting Judge Edwin Cameron said that the bail fund would address the injustice of being detained simply because of poverty and make an impact on overcrowding in prisons. So currently there are about 742 people in prison who can't afford bail in Gauteng and 792 in the Western Cape. Cameron said that there will be what we call a band-aid. They are not looking to make a systematic change, rather. So he added that they might face resistance to the bail fund. They acknowledged that. He said that he said to be exact, right, we might be exposed to risk, yes, but in their view, the human cost and the gross injustice of unaffordable bail is too stark to ignore. So Cameron further explained that the bail fund will be extra institutional. It will operate outside the structures of the National Prosecuting Authority, the courts, the Department of Correctional Services, and JICS rather. The fund will also be closely tailored and target low-risk offenders. Good. Recipients would be those who committed petty offences with a bail amount of under 1,000 rand. Anton du Plessis from the National Prosecuting Authority, Deputy National Director of Public Prosecutions, said during the meeting that the bail fund is fully in line with NPA's policy approach. Du Plessis went on to say that where any bail amount is less than 1,000 rand, right, it's really incumbent on the prosecutor and on policy to make sure that those people don't get stuck and remain in prison because they can't pay the bail. He went on to say that they are meant to be pushing harder on this. Clearly, looking at the numbers that they've been put out, they're not pushing hard enough to make sure every effort is made that people who can't afford those low amounts of bail are not kept in incarceration. So representing the Department of Correctional Services, the Chief Deputy Commissioner of Remand Detention, Cynthia Ramulifo, expressed support for the bail fund, particularly that it would address overcrowding in prisons. Makes a point, so that the people that commit more serious offences can have space and not be let free to torment their victims again. So she said that the number of remandees, which these are people in prison who are waiting trial in the Eastern Cape who do not have money to pay bail, is also growing. She said the bail fund would benefit the state as it would save the cost incurred by the department in paying food, electricity and medical services to those who are supposed to be outside of the facilities. So looking at other bail funds in other countries, the current research is aimed at assisting in establishing the South African Bail Fund, right? This is spearheaded by a team of students from Harvard Law School, advocates for human rights, looking at bail funds worldwide. The research highlighted that cash bail is starkly unequal in societies like South Africa, creating an inherently unequal criminal justice system in which one freedom is determined by their socioeconomic class. So the Harvard study reads, these individuals are said to be presumed innocent until proven guilty, yet they are subject to prison conditions and navigate consequences with no immediate prospect of release or access to rehabilitation programs. Right. The Malawi Bail Project is an access to justice project which assists those who have committed minor offenses to apply for bail during their first court appearances. The project focuses on educating people on their right to bail, good, and aims to increase the number of bail applications in court. The Malawi Bail Project explains on its website that due to a lack of legal aid lawyers, in Malawi, many people are arrested and brought to court without legal representation and are unaware of their right to bail. This means thousands of Malawians are detained in severely overcrowded prisons. The Malawi Bail Fund, the Malawi Bail Project's aim is then broader than solely dealing with the monetary hurdle, according to the study. So the study also says that it also empowers remand detainees to know their rights and exercise them while also focusing on the capacity building of criminal justice system. Back in the United States, the nonprofit organization, the Bail Project, provides bail funding to thousands of people who cannot afford it. The organization also provides them with court support after release, including transport to court. This would probably work out in helping overcrowded prisons. It will also work out in helping people that cannot afford bail. This article was courtesy of The Ground Up. Now, moving to a more good news for motorists in South Africa, more fuel price relief is on the cards for South Africa this week. So with moderate petrol and diesel price decreases set to come into effect from Wednesday, which is May 7th, the Central Energy Fund has confirmed price decreases to 32 cents per litre for 95 unleaded petrol and 21 cents for 93 unleaded, while diesel will go down by between 41 cents and 42 cents. So what does this mean for pumps, you might ask? South Africans will now pay 21 rand 29 cents for a litre of 93 unleaded petrol in the inland regions from Wednesday, with 95 ULP retailing at 21.40 cents, while the coastal price will fall to 20 rand 60 cents. So this will lead to savings to around 6.60 per tank to those refueling a small car with 30 litres, while a 50-litre refuel in the medium vehicle will cost 11 rand less. So those putting 70 litres of diesel into a larger bucky or SUV can look forward to savings of around 28.70. So were it not for the weaker rand, South Africans would have been in line for fuel price cuts in the region of 50 cents, can you imagine that, for petrol and 70 cents for diesel. These are definitely great news for motorists. At this point, I actually wish I had a car. Although when the fuel price goes up, I probably wouldn't be able to afford it. But, you know, at this point, I wish I had one. That was courtesy of IOL. Let's take a quick ad break and we'll be right back. So, we often look at police officers, right? We often look at police officers as especially like a police station, right? I mean, when you get into a police station, you see that, you know what, this is a protected place. It's not even protected, but like it's a safe space. It's where it's a place where you keep criminals. Right? Inside. It's a place where you keep criminals and not have criminals coming inside just on their own. Like okay, let's start that again. When we often look at prisons or police stations, we often feel safe as your like normal citizen. You go there to certify documents. You go there to lay a charge. You know, it's a place where we know that our perpetrators are put there and they're holding cells, and it's going to keep them inside, right? It's going to keep them inside, and also it keeps them outside for them not to be able to easily get in. Like, you think of, oh, okay, you're going to keep, you know, we think of prisons as places where they keep criminals inside and locked up and et cetera, right? But now, this is kind of shocking that police in the Eastern Cape are investigating a break-in and theft of several. Okay, we're going to start again because that doesn't make sense. Right? Okay. So often look at traffic departments. We go to traffic departments to do your licenses, learner's licenses, and all of that stuff, right? And it's a place where security guarded. It's a government. It's a government owned thing, right? It's owned by government, right? And it should be guarded and protected. But now you find it funny that police in the Eastern Cape are investigating a break-in and theft of several firearms, which now firearms are going to be sold in the streets and increased to teenagers carrying firearms around. But I digress. And theft of firearms at a local traffic department. So the case is currently being investigated by members of the Humonstorp South African Police Service. Provincial police spokesperson Brigadier Nobuntu Kadana said a case of burglary and theft is being investigated after a break-in at the Koga local municipality traffic department offices on Hugh Street in Humonstorp. The accident is believed to have occurred between 3 p.m. on Friday, 25th of April, 2025, when the premises were last secured. Where the security guards, and 6:45 a.m. on Tuesday, April 29th, 2025. So when the break-in was discovered. So the break-in happened on the 25th and was discovered on the 29th of April. So preliminary investigations indicate that heavy machinery was used to breach the building's roof to gain entry. Among the items stolen are 17 firearms and an undisclosed amount of cash. Authorities are currently pursuing all leads and the investigation continues. This is according to Kandana. Police have confirmed that no arrests have been made yet, and anyone with information was urged to come forward. I feel like you understand what I'm getting at, right? Like, the robbery is believed to have occurred on the 25th of April, but then was discovered on the 29th of April. How is that possible? But I do hope that they catch the thieves, they catch, and also that they recover these 17 firearms, because we really cannot have guns out on the streets at this moment, because it's... we're getting overwhelmed, guys. Those are a lot of firearms. I do hope that they arrest the people and they retrieve the firearms. Unfortunately, we have reached the end of our Medivas podcast. I do hope that you catch us again, same time, same place, next week. For me, Pearl, with all things science, technology, health, environment, and health. Check you out next week. Bye.
The best youth station in the Bay.
Medivas Radio.